Right, tonight let's go to Genesis chapter 37, and we'll complete out in this session what we have been doing as a short topic, and that is the importance of decisions and the concept of volition. Genesis 37. Here's where we have gone and where we're ready to start tonight. We broke the subject of volition, man's capacity to make choices, into three classes. First of all, certain general considerations about volition and will. Mainly, we mentioned the fact that we are free to choose or to will anything that we wish to will. However, we cannot execute everything we wish or will. God does not put any restrictions on what we may will. He does put restrictions on what can be carried out by our own will. As we said last time, I could stand here and I'm perfectly free to will to disappear. It won't work, but I'm free to will that. Then we said also we need to keep in mind that God is not out to break our wills. He is out to see us make good decisions with our volition. Then we went to some of the implications of the freedom to choose. And the major one is freedom of choice involves responsibility for that choice, so that as we make choices, we're fully responsible for them. And we spent, I think, almost all of our last session emphasizing that particular point. Now, tonight, we're ready to complete by looking at some of the complications that are involved in volition. And by complications, we simply mean this. By complications, we mean that a believer often finds himself in situations not of his own choosing. There are certain things we can choose to do and bring about. There are certain circumstances in life that put us in a situation that we would prefer not to be in, that we would even choose to be out of. The believer often finds himself in situations not of his own choosing. And that's the thing we want to focus on tonight, is how should we react and act in situations of that sort. Examples of this would be a believer, because of his faith in Christ in a certain country, being put in a prison camp. He didn't choose to go into that prison camp. He's there as a result of a choice, but it's a circumstance he did not choose. A child in a home where he's mistreated. You have a 2-year-old, 3-year-old in a home, he's being mistreated. He didn't choose to be in that home, and yet he is in that situation. And we'll also look at Joseph from age 17 for about 14 years. He was in a situation that he did not choose to be in. Daniel that we're studying. Daniel was at home in Jerusalem. He was taken captive to Babylon. He didn't choose to do that. He was taken there as captive. As we come to the chapter 6, the fiery furnace, the young men that were put in the fiery furnace didn't choose to get in the fiery furnace. They didn't say, oh, look, a fiery furnace, let's jump in. It wasn't their own choosing. And the lion's den, in which we'll find Daniel in our next study on Sunday morning, he is put in the fiery furnace, or put in the lion's den. And that is not because Daniel developed an affection for lions and decided he would like to live with them. He didn't choose to be there, and he was put there in a situation not of his own choosing. Now, you may be. In most of the thing for us, thankfully, we're in a free country, and most of the situations we're in are of our own choosing. We'll all experience one that is not of our own choosing, and that's the way we will die. We don't get to pick the method or the means that we exit from this life. We'll have to wait and see what that situation is. So perhaps it would help tonight in studying through this to think of perhaps a situation in which you find yourself. You didn't choose to get there. You didn't choose to be there. Maybe it's physical. You didn't choose to look like you look. You would like to choose otherwise. You didn't choose to be as tall or short as you happen to be, and you're in that, but you're nonetheless in that situation. There may be certain things about your job that are unpleasant and you didn't choose for this person to be your supervisor or to have to supervise this nerd. And consequently, it was not of your choice. You're in this position. You have to do it anyway. And therefore, how do we look at situations that are not of our own choosing? But let's put down, first of all, a principle that comes off of that, and that is this. Even in unchosen circumstances, even in unchosen circumstances, and life is full of those things, even in unchosen circumstances, we are fully responsible for how we respond. Emphasis, and we'll underscore it, we are fully responsible for how we react in that situation. And even in a situation we did not choose to be in, if our reactions are correct, we're in the driver's seat. And that's encouraging, very encouraging when we see that. Now we'll look at the classic example of a young man being in a set of circumstances that he did not choose, but his responses and his reactions are a tremendous example. And we're talking about Joseph. Now, when we go to the life of Joseph, there are two basic lessons that keep coming through. And I say two lessons, there are dozens of lessons, but two that we want to focus on. One of the first thing that the book of, or the narrative of the life of Joseph teaches us is this, that the sovereignty of God does not contradict the responsibility of man. The sovereignty of God does not contradict the responsibility of man. For that, let's go to chapter 41 of Genesis. 41, verse 25. In chapter 41, notice an emphasis that God, in His sovereign way, is going to do something, and nothing can prevent it. So coming down to verse 25, Pharaoh has had a dream of the lean cattle and the fat cattle, and he wants to know what the dream means. So Joseph says, verse 25, to Pharaoh, Pharaoh's dreams are one and the same. God has told Pharaoh what he is about to do. Notice, no question, Pharaoh, do you want it? Do you approve of it? This is what God is going to do. The seven cows are 7 years, and the seven good years are seven years. The dreams are one and the same. And the seven lean and ugly cows that came up after them are 7 years, and the seven thin ears scorched by the east wind shall be 7 years of famine. It is, as I have spoken to Pharaoh, God has shown Pharaoh what he is about to do. Behold, 7 years of great abundance are coming in all the land of Egypt. After them, 7 years of famine will come. All the abundance will be forgotten in the land of Egypt, and the famine will ravage the land. And there it is. There's going to be seven good years followed by seven bad years. Now, there is absolutely nothing that you can do to change it. So the philosophy would be, well, let's eat, drink, and be merry during the 7 years because it's going to be followed by seven of no food at all, and we will die. Therefore, that's what God has declared. God is sovereign, and there's nothing we can do. Well, notice coming down to the following verses, and that is verse 34. Notice they're going to do something to prepare for the lean years. He says, let Pharaoh take action to appoint overseers in charge of the land, and let him exact a fifth of the produce of the land of Egypt in the 7 years of abundance. Then let them gather all the food of those good years that are coming, store up the grain for the food in the cities under Pharaoh's authority, and let them guard it. Let the food become as a reserve for the land for the 7 years of famine, which will occur in the land of Egypt, so that the land may not perish during the famine. So notice there was human responsibility, and the emphasis is God has announced there's going to be a famine. And therefore Joseph says, well, that's his announcement, that's his sovereign declaration, and we'll do nothing, not at all. As soon as he heard of the seven lean years, he began to prepare by taking a certain amount during the good years and save. The sovereignty of God does not contradict the responsibility of man to act. The second important lesson is this life of Joseph teaches the personal involvement of God in the life of his children. Teaches the personal involvement of God in the lives of his children. And that lesson comes throughout the entire book. Let's go back to chapter 39. Notice in the midst of horrible circumstances, or at least some horrible things that had happened to Joseph, notice that emphasis just throughout chapter 39, verses 2 and 3. And the Lord was with Joseph, so he became a successful man. He was in captivity. He wasn't free. But notice he was a successful man, and it was due to the personal blessing of the Lord. And he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. His master saw that the Lord was with him and how the Lord had caused all that he did to prosper in his hand. Verse 5, came about when the time, from that time he made him overseer in his house. Over all that he owned, the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house on account of Joseph. Thus the Lord's blessing was upon all that he owned in his house and in the field. Verse 21, but the Lord was with Joseph and extended kindness to him. Verse 23, the chief jailer did not supervise anything under Joseph's charge because the Lord was with him, and whatever he did, the Lord made to prosper. So two very important lessons that come through in this particular book. Now, let's note that the situation that Joseph was in was totally unchosen. In the first place, when he was barely 16, his mother died. Now, we all have choices in when mother dies, right? He had no choice in that whatsoever. That was not his choice. Go back to chapter 37. Verse 3. It says, Now Israel loved Joseph more than all his sons. And Joseph, I'm sure, appreciated that, but he didn't choose that because he was the son of his old age, and he made him a very colored tunic. And his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, and so they hated him. That's not a pleasant situation to be in. You may say, I've had brothers or sisters that yell that they hate me. But I doubt that you've ever been thrown in a pit. I doubt that you've ever been sold as property. I doubt that they've ever attempted literally to kill you. That's the situation that Joseph was in. He did not choose that. He did not choose to have jealous brothers, but nonetheless he had them. Verse 20, got all kinds of, says, now then, this is his brother speaking, come, let us kill him, throw him into one of the pits, and we will say a wild beast devoured him. And of course they catch him and they do throw him into the pit. So down at verse 28, some Midianite traders passed by, so they pulled him up and lifted Joseph out of the pit, into which pit Joseph did not choose to go. And they sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver, and so forth on down through, noting that the hateful things that the brothers did to Joseph. Now, the important thing that we're coming to, however, is in the midst of this unwanted, unchosen circumstances, he is responsible for his reactions. He's responsible for the way that he reacts to it. Now, the essence of doing that, not being, naturally, usually, when we get in situations that are unpleasant that we didn't choose, what's a human thing to do? Is complain. Talk about how unfairly we've been treated, and maybe we have, or how unfair life is, and perhaps do it long enough that we become bitter. There's only one key to handling situations in which we find ourselves that we did not choose to be, and there's only one way to handle it successfully, and it's this. That is to see the hand of God in the midst of it. And if we can see that, we can handle the situation, and that is true all the way through with Joseph. Go over to chapter 45. And he very clearly sees the hand of God in all of it. The way we usually do is it's easy to see the hand of God when something good happens to us, right? I can thank the Lord for good things He sends my way easily. The difficulty is, can I see God's hand as equally in ugly situations as I can in good ones? He's equally there. God doesn't just respond to good situations. God is present in every situation. And notice Joseph has that kind of mentality. Chapter 45. And if this isn't a laid-back view of life, and if this isn't seeing the hand of God in everything, I don't know how you could put it more clearly. What has happened is he's risen to prime minister in Egypt, and his brothers experience famine, and they've come down to Egypt because they need food. And they come in before Joseph, and at first they do not recognize him, because verse 4 says, Joseph, let's go back to 3. Joseph said to his brother, I am Joseph. Is my father still alive? But the brothers could not answer him, for they were dismayed at his presence. You can imagine that. They tried to kill the man, they've sold him, and now he's prime minister, and he can lop all of their heads off. But look at his view of life, verse 4. Joseph said to his brothers, please come closer to me. And they came closer and probably shook more. And he said, I'm your brother Joseph, whom you guys sold into Egypt. Now don't be grieved or angry with yourselves because you sold me here. For God sent me before you to preserve life. How's that for seeing the hand of God in an ugly situation? For the famine has been in the land these 2 years, and there are still 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvesting. And God sent me before you to preserve for you a remnant in the earth and to keep you alive by a great deliverance. Who is in control? Notice how Joseph is in the driver's seat. You see the laid-back type of lifestyle he has. You see that all flowing out of the fact that he is able to see the hand of God in garbage. And that's all you can say. This is as low a thing as brothers could do to brothers, to attempt to kill him, to sell him, to hate him. And yet he says that was the hand of God in the midst of it all. Now that's a tough mental attitude. What that is Romans 8:28 attitude. Let's go to Romans 8:28. Verse 28, and we know that God causes all things to work together for good to those who love God, to those who are called according to His purpose. Now, the first thing we ought to see is the context of Romans 8:28. Let's just jot down some notes about the verse. It's a verse most Christians quote. The question is, do we have Romans 8:28 mentalities? Is that the way we always think? Well, first of all, note the context of Romans 8:28. He's talking about all things working together for good. And what is the context? Is this a happy context or something different? Well, go back to the same chapter and look in chapter 8, verse 18. We'll look at four verses that will give us the context. For I consider, this is verse 18 now, I consider that the sufferings of this present time, what's the context? It's the context of suffering. Verse 20, for the creation was subjected to futility. Context of suffering, a context of futility. Verse 21, that the creation also will be set free from its slavery. So you got suffering, you got futility, you've got slavery. Verse 22, we know that the whole creation groans and suffers the pains of childbirth. So you've got groaning and moaning and childbirth pains and suffering and futility. That's the whole context. Now the question is, in the context of all of that, can we see God? And it's therefore the context is a context of groans. Groans of life. Now, there is nothing in Romans 8 about what we can do about the groans of life. not a word about how we can change them, improve upon them, but there is a reward, there is a means of how we can look at them. And so the key to being in control in the midst of the groans of life is Romans 8:28 mentality. And Romans 8:28 mentality is, very simply, we see the hand of God in all of it. See, that's the difference between your mature and immature believer. Mature and immature believers all go through the same muck, all go through the same thing. The difference with the mature believer, the one that's in control, is he sees God's hand in it all. And the one who does not cannot see the hand of God, and consequently he can go into all kinds of pattern, blame himself, blame his parents, blame the environment, blame what he's surrounded with, blame who he has to work for, blame who he has to supervise, blame who he has to live with, and all of those things, and eventually get bitter with all of them, divorce them and dump them, and et cetera, rather than seeing, in the midst of all of this, God's hand, which is Romans 8:28. Now, notice, this kind of mentality can't become just a... I mean, you can't wail Romans 8:28 and have it do anything for you. It's a confident verse. Notice the first two words. And we know. The words "we know" are a favorite of Paul's. In fact, in Paul's writings, it'd be an interesting thing to take a concordance and note some of Paul's things that he is absolutely certain of, that he knows. He uses this little expression about 30 times in his writings. And the usage of it is to introduce what is common knowledge. Is used to introduce what is common knowledge among those who have been taught by the apostles. Just put among taught believers. And Paul inevitably will take matters that any instructed believer knows and has become common knowledge, so that if you would say Romans 8:28 to the church at... if you'd say, "We know all things work together for good to them that love the Lord," if you'd say that at the church of Colossae, they would all understand that. So would the church at Ephesus. So would the church at Philippi. So would the church in Greece. So would the church at Rome. Those things that the apostles taught that everybody knew, and this is one of them, and that is that the hand of God is involved in everything. The second thing to say, there's the usage of the word. The word oida is used for knowledge based on fact. Foundation is facts. And Paul is simply saying, I want to introduce something that every believer ought to know is common fact. All right, the next thing we have is we know that God causes all things to work together for good. Let me say something about the word "for good." In the first place, the little word "for" is a preposition we've used many times and talked about. It's the preposition "ace." And the basal meaning of it is always direction toward. And thus it's used to express goal. Therefore, we know that God causes all things to work together, and they all take the direction of good. Now, what is the next thing that we could easily take incorrectly? That is, what is meant by the word "good"? What is the good that he's talking about? And the obvious answer to that is the good that he is talking about is things that make us feel good. God works everything together in order to make his children feel good. Right? Well, obviously, the word "good" has to be defined from some standpoint. First, and let's put it our parameters for it, must be defined from God's standpoint, not man's. Must be defined from God's standpoint. The logic behind that, obviously, he is the source of all good. Consequently, he's the definer of it. So, he makes all things in our lives work together for good from his standpoint. In defining what good is, if you would say, that was a good baseball, that was a good pitch. What is a good pitch? It all depends on whether you're the pitcher or the batter. You know, the batter puts one over the fence, comes back to the dugout and says, boy, that's a good pitch. Meaning that's one that was good from my perspective. It was good to hit over the fence. The pitcher would say, as he strikes out the last man, that was a good pitch. Meaning it's the one you missed. And therefore, words have to be defined from the proper standpoint. And we're looking at God's standpoint here of what is good in his from his standpoint. The second thing that we have to do with that is to recognize that we may or may not, we may or may not see what this good is. We may or we may not see what the good is. God may bring a set of circumstances to bear and work them in such a way that they will have an impact 50 years after we're dead. He can do that, can't he? And you know, but when he does so, he always tells us. He always whispers in our ear, the way I'm working things, I know you don't see how they're working out right now, but let me whisper something to you. 50 years down, it'll be a blessing to Aunt Bessie. Okay. Not at all. So we may or may not, we simply have to believe that God is in control of his universe and that what he is working for good, sometimes we get the reward of seeing what that good thing was. Sometimes we don't get to see what that is, but it doesn't make any difference. We know that it's good at any rate. God is under no obligation to tell us why a certain set of events is better than another. Now, there is a regulating principle in the way God acts. Reading verse 28 again. And we know that God causes all things to work together in the direction of good as defined by him. To those who love God, to those who are called, and here's a regulating phrase, who are called according to his purpose. And the word to focus on there is the word purpose. The word purpose is a word that means, and again, purpose is a good translation, but it's inevitably used. We could talk about a purpose, someone having a purpose and an intent. And from the word purpose, you don't know, is it a good purpose? Is it a malicious purpose? Is it a self-serving purpose? What kind is it? This particular word is inevitably used of intelligent purchase, a purpose. And I would not hesitate to translate the Greek word prothesis is coming off of verse 28, according to his intelligent or according to his wise purpose and his wise plan. And notice the idea then is that all these things are brought together by God to serve a good purpose. I think the best illustration of that perhaps would be you go and look on the kitchen counter. And there's a cup of flour, there's salt, there's pepper, there's garlic, there's a stick of butter, there's milk. Which one would you, they're all food, which one would you like to eat? You say, well, let's have a cup of flour for breakfast. It'd be a horrible meal. Or let's have a garlic bud for lunch. All of those things by themselves, unworked by a cook, are in themselves unpleasant. Well, you could take those same ingredients and add some other things and work them together with a good cook, and you've got an excellent meal. And that is the picture of Romans 8:28. This happens, this happens, this happens, this happens. And boy, that last experience was a garlic bud. The last one was a cup full of flour, and it was tough to take. And the next one was high in cholesterol. It was a stick of butter. And then I had to eat peppercorns, and it burnt my mouth, and it was a bad experience. And you look at all of those things isolated, and they're unpleasant. And Romans 8:28 is saying God takes all of those things and puts them together and comes up with something good and something that serves intelligent purpose. And that is the kind of mentality that we need to develop. It is the kind of mentality that Joseph had. Now let's go back to his life once more. Chapter 37. Chapter 37. And we've seen them, but verse 5. Joseph had a dream. When he told it to his brothers, they hated him even more. Verse 8, his brothers said to him, "Are you actually going to reign over us? Are you going to really rule over us?" So they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. Verse 18, when they saw him from a distance, before he came close to him, they plotted against him to put him to death. Verse 24, they took him, threw him in a pit. And all of these things are irksome as they can possibly be. But think of this. All of these irksome things God took, Joseph didn't have to do it, God took and brought them together so that in the final chapters, the only reason that the nation of Israel, which was then the 12 brothers, the only reason that they did not starve to death was Joseph. And all of those things brought him into the right place. Usually, the things that God brings the most blessing out of are not good things that happen to us. Most of the things that God miraculously brings together for a wonderful purpose are the bad things, the bad days, the rotten days, the lousy days that God is able to bring together for something very, very great. All right, now let's go to the life of Paul. And for that, Philippians 1. Philippians 1. Paul, first of all, let me make an observation off of Paul's some 12, 13 epistles. Paul spent 4 years in a Roman jail. Horrible circumstances. I think it's interesting that out of those 4 years that were horrible in circumstances, as over against his free years, when he could move about and do as he pleased, when he was in Roman prison, he wrote Ephesians, Philippians, and Colossians. The three most Christological books of the New Testament. Where did the fullest explanation of the person and the work of Christ come from? Out of a Roman jail. God more likely will take the unpleasant experiences of life and bring something good from them than the others. But notice one little note here in Philippians chapter 1. And let's get get the context of where he is in life. Verse 7. For it's only right for me to feel this way about you because I have you in my heart. Since both in my imprisonment, he's in jail, you come down to verse 50, not only is he in jail, but the people that are not in jail want to make it hard on him. They want to make it difficult. So verse 15, some, to be sure, are preaching Christ even from envy and strife, that is toward Paul, but some of goodwill. The latter do it out of love, knowing that I'm appointed for the defense of the gospel. The former proclaim Christ out of selfish ambition rather than pure motives, thinking it caused me distress in my imprisonment. In other words, they're not only satisfied that he's in jail, but we want to make him miserable in jail. Now, you come down to verse 12, and as he writes to the Philippian believers, he says as follows. Now, I want you to know, brethren, that my circumstances, which were ugly, have turned out, and our New American leaves out a very important word here, rather, turned out rather for the greater progress of the gospel. A couple of things. First of all, when he talks about his circumstances, the Greek text uses a very interesting expression. It uses the expression ta, the kata, meaning under, or coming down like a catastrophe, and then the word me, and it is literally all the things that have come down on me. So he says, I want you to know, brethren, that all the things that have crashed on me, all the things that have come down on me, all the things that have been dumped on me, have turned out rather, and the word rather simply means things haven't turned out the way you would think they would. with all of this being piled on me, you would think things would have gotten worse. They didn't. They have turned out rather for the progress of the gospel. What was Paul able to do to see when he was dumped on? See the hand of God. That's what Joseph could do. That's what Paul could do. And that is the Romans chapter 8, verse 28 mentality. Now, let's do one other thing, and I'm going to be a little bit piecemeal from here on out because I want to finish tonight with this and get back to the sixth chapter of Daniel in our next study. But let's take, we've talked about how we're responsible for our actions. And now, in the life of Joseph, we see that we're also responsible for reactions. What is the difference between actions and reactions? First is this. Actions can be planned. We're all good at that. You can calculate and plan ahead of time what you're going to do. And since they can be planned ahead of time, that means we can plan our actions in order to get the response that we want. What's that called? It's called manipulation, yes. When we plan actions to calculate to get the self-centered result that we want, it's the practical means of implementing self-centeredness. It's the opposite of being open with people. However, when you come to a reaction, reactions cannot be planned. I'm talking about those that are spontaneous. I mean, I'm talking about like something just unexpected suddenly happens. And the first thing we do is react. You're just out of the blue. Someone just comes up and kicks you. And you react. Now, when we think of these two things, we ought to remember this. Bad actions tell a lot. Bad reactions tell all. And therefore, these two relate together and very, 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 very important. And basically, a reaction reveals how we were thinking at the moment it happened. Reactions reveal whether doctrine and the truth of the Word of God was in the forefront of our mind when we just got kicked. Because a reaction is, you don't have time to think and say, well, now, wait a minute, I've just been kicked. I got to think. I'm not going to do anything yet. I don't know whether to run, hit, protect myself, get mad, not get mad, laugh it off. You can't do that. Have you ever tried to have something happen to you suddenly and say, well, I don't know whether I'm going to get mad yet. Give me 5 minutes to think it over, and in 5 minutes you get mad. No, reactions are too quick for that, and they show the way we're thinking and what's in our minds at the time. Now, since we're talking about the believer's will, let's finish up tonight with a couple of passages relative to God's will for the believer. 1 Timothy 2:4. And the reason for closing with this is obviously the object of the Christian life is to learn to submit to God's will. And we'll just list a few passages that pertain. First one is 1 Timothy 2 and verse 4. Well, we need to go to verse 3, don't we? This is good and acceptable in the sight of God, our Savior, who desires. Now, we're looking at the will of God, and success in the Christian life, obviously, is when our will is in accord with His. Who desires all men to be saved, period. God's desire is that we get to heaven. Well, notice there is no period there. There is the word and to come to knowledge of the truth. So notice you've got the will of God relative to man in two areas. Number one, relative to phase one of salvation. He wants all men to be saved. The word saved has three important grammatical features to it. First one, the word saved is an aorist tense. And that says this as an event, not a process. This is something that happens. It's an event. It's not a procedure. So it's the will of God that all men get saved, have an event in their life whereby, having heard the gospel, they believe on Christ and instantaneously they are saved. Second, it's in a passive voice. And the passive voice means acted upon, not actor. Acted on, not actor. Don't save yourself, you are saved. And then it is grammatically an infinitive. In fact, there are two infinitives expressing God's purpose. Infinitives in Greek inevitably are used to express purpose. So God's will relative to phase one of salvation is that the event of salvation come to pass. And that simply means we hear the gospel, we put our faith in Christ, and like that we are saved. Now, notice God's will does not stop there, because you have the word and, who desires all men to be saved and to come to the knowledge of the truth. So here is the will of God relative to phase two of salvation. Phase one is becoming a Christian. Phase two is living as a Christian. Notice, first of all, God's purpose is not satisfied by just evangelism. We can say it emphatically. It is not the privilege of any church or any organization to exist just for the purpose of evangelism. And the reason is that we are here to participate in the total will of God. And the total will of God is more than just that. It includes it, obviously. But it is the and to come to knowledge of the truth. And that's phase two. So notice it is God desires, in phase two, to instill divine viewpoint values in his children. The word knowledge, by the way, is the word epignosis. Spell it out and show you the idea involved in it. Compound word. Greek loves to take a noun and put a preposition on the front of it. This noun means to know or knowledge. And epi is the preposition meaning upon. We've got it in epilogue in English. It's the word after, epi, word put upon the monologue or the story. And what they do is they intensify and they direct. So the idea of epignosis would be intense knowledge or full knowledge and accurate knowledge. So, in verse 4, he desires for all men to be saved, and obviously then in sequence to come to a full and an accurate knowledge of the truth. It is God's will that his children grow. Ephesians 5:15 through 17. Few passages relative to the will of God and the believer. Ephesians 5:15. Therefore, be careful. The word be careful, akrabos, is a Greek term that means to be very accurate and to pay very close attention. So therefore, pay very close attention how you walk, not as, in a play on words, not as asaphos, but as sophos. Meaning, again, wise, unwise. Wise person, obviously, is one that has a divine viewpoint mentality, the unwise does not. Making the most of your time, verse 16, because the days are evil, so then do not be foolish, but understand. Understand is the word, a compound word again, for a word meaning to bring, and then the preposition on the front, together. But bringing it together, how would we put it? The Greeks talked about bringing it together. We talk about getting it together. And that's a good translation. We are to get it together as to what the will of the Lord is. And notice, by the way, how do we get it together spiritually? On the basis of emotion? No, on the basis of mental attitude. Understand. That's how we get it together. It's a mental word, a word used for the activity of the mind. So then, do not be foolish, but have an active mind that gets it together as to what the will of the Lord is. Notice the idea of the will of the Lord is not a hand-wringing situation. It's something we can know and we are to know. Finally, go over to two books to the right, to Colossians 4:12. The whole verse is going to center around what Epaphras wants for these Colossian believers. Epaphras, who is one of your number, a bondslave of Jesus Christ, sends his greetings. Always laboring earnestly. Laboring earnestly, agonizomai, our word agony in English. And it is a very intense word for labor, who is always laboring, agonizing for you in his prayers, that you may stand perfect and fully assured in all the will of God. The word perfect is a word for complete. The word fully assured is a good translation. I want them to be mature. I want them to be confident in all the will of God. And, of course, the means of doing so is through the Word of God. Now, that's why we will go back in our next study to the book of Daniel and systematically move through from chapter 6 into chapter 7, which will become section of prophecy in the book of Daniel, and get it together as far as the will of the Lord is concerned. And then we have the groundwork on which we can make good quality decisions and use our volition, the capacity to choose, in a way that honors God. Father, we're thankful for the fact that you are straight with us. We're thankful that we don't have to be victims. We're thankful that we may be in the most unpleasant circumstance in the world, and something that we can do nothing about, cannot change, cannot improve on. And yet we're thankful that you are God. And that common truth to believers is we know that all these things work together for good as you see it. And they're all intelligent purpose, and therefore to bring honor and glory to yourself. We give you thanks for this in Christ's name.